Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from our studio in London. I'm Lise Doucette. In a moment, Russia warns the West not to allow Ukraine to use Western arms against target inside Russia, or else. That's our main story today. Also in the programme, devastating floods in Myanmar lead the military ruler to ask for international assistance. And as the funeral takes place of the Olympic athlete Rebecca Cheptegei, murdered by a former boyfriend, we'll speak to her coach about his friend.
I missed all the jokes, the laughs and the determination, the courage in training. I really miss Rebecca. She has been one of the most disciplined athletes, very determined, very committed in her career. She used to talk to the athletes, the young athletes, in a very proper way. Just that we have really lost one of those whom we thought she would mentor other young athletes.
That's all coming up in about half an hour, so do stay with us. But we start with the war of words between Moscow, Washington and London. It's hotting up as tensions escalate over the war in Ukraine. It seems to have been the top issue on the agenda when Britain's Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer sat down with President Joe Biden in the White House. The two leaders are being very coy about whether they've decided to shift their long-standing opposition to Ukraine's use of long-range missiles they provide to attack Russia. After the meeting, Sir Keir told journalists the meeting focused on strategy, not tactics.
This wasn't a meeting about a particular capability. That wasn't why we got our heads down today. It was to allow ourselves the space, which we took, the time which we took, to have a strategic discussion so that tactical decisions can be seen within the wider strategy. And it was a really good invitation for the president.
And the White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, reiterated that point too.
There's been no policy change, but what I can continue to make sure that you all know and you see it for yourself is that the president is committed to make sure that Ukraine has what it needs to defend itself against Russia's aggression, to defend and fight for their democracy.
Well, so this is what the West is now saying, but it has provoked some very, very threatening words from Russia. The former Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has warned that among Russia's possible reactions, it could be the use of nuclear weapons or other deadly weapons in Russia's arsenal. Now, it's not the first time that Russia has warned that its red lines are being crossed, but is it different this time? Sergei Markov is a former advisor to President Putin and used to be an MP in his political party. On a crackly line to Moscow, I asked whether this time was different.
NATO country has a strategy of escalation of the war, step by step. But now, a few months in Russia, we can see the discussion how to stop this strategy of escalation, which is conducted by Western countries. And finally, the conclusion is that Russia should also respond by own escalation. It's exactly what Vladimir Putin told. That's why, after the old statement of Vladimir Putin, Joe Biden and the British Prime Minister decided not to claim this decision right now, but to take some pause to think how to react.
You describe it, Russian officials describe it as escalation. But the United States and Britain say they are doing it in response to what they say is Iran's providing of long-range missiles to Russia. And they say it's a defensive move to protect Ukraine from significant Russian attacks on Ukrainian territory.
Yes, it's partly true. But United States and Great Britain take part in the war. They do it on the side of Ukraine. But the difference is that if your officers, if your generals, if you British American militaries are targeting to the Russian cities, Russia will have to respond to you.
As you know, President Putin has spoken of red lines before when it came to Western tanks, F-16s. Is this red line different?
It looks like this red line difference exactly because Russia didn't react strongly. It was the reason why now Western politicians saying, oh, no. Russia have, in fact, real red lines. It just Putin talking, but he afraid to do something. So we don't afraid escalation. Putin afraid escalation. So go ahead to the way of escalation, and we will put Russia to the knees. And Putin finally decided, okay, they believe that they can go away of escalation. Now we have to change the rule of games. We will give the response. Nuclear weaponry, okay, let's do it.
Just to be clear on that, are you saying that the use of nuclear weapons by Russia is a possibility?
Yes, it's on the stage, in fact. I just been on the big discussion 1 month ago of so-called forum, Russian Army 2024, and most of the experts saying, using tactical nuclear weaponry becoming inevitable. Using of Russian tactical nuclear weaponry, it's an imminent decision for de-escalation.
When you talk about tactical nuclear weapons, would this include targeting territory outside of Ukraine, in NATO members, for example?
Yes, because we believe that people in Russia, in Ukraine, they are Russians. So why we should destroy Ukraine, which will be part of the Russia in the future? It's better to make a strike of tactical nuclear weapon to the Romania and Poland airfield, because they are, in fact, guilty.
You appreciate that if this threat is carried out, it will be regarded as highly reckless, deeply dangerous, and will have blowback that will damage Russia in the end.
This will damage Russia, but the strategy which Russia used before, we could see, led to the absolutely dramatic and bad situation which we have now. Western countries ready to continue escalation. What we can hear from Western politicians: don't afraid Russia, beat Russia, make escalation against Russia. Any war against Russia except nuclear weaponry possible. It's exactly what we want to stop.
Fighting words indeed from the former advisor to President Putin, Sergei Markov. He's an ex-United Russia MP. Well, let's get some analysis of this, these war words. Stephen Biddle is the Professor of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University and joins us now. Good morning to you, Stephen Biddle.
Good morning.
You heard Sergei Markov saying that he's been at meetings in Moscow saying that nuclear weapons are not off the table. It's not the first time Russia has threatened the use of nuclear weapons. What do you think of it this time?
Well, they're not off the table, but that doesn't mean their use is likely. For Russia to use nuclear weapons would be a gamble on a truly historic scale. So I think the likeliest scenario in which Russia might actually use them is if there's some sort of military catastrophe that threatens the regime. If Putin concludes that his choices are keep nuclear weapons in storage, have a military disaster, end up with a coup d'etat in Moscow that threatens his regime and his life, or take a historic gamble and use nuclear weapons, then you could imagine that nuclear weapons might look attractive enough to take that gamble. That kind of military catastrophe on the ground isn't imminent, certainly, and probably isn't likely at all, given the nature of the war at this point in its course. But this whole tendency to look at escalation as a red line, on one side of which is nuclear war, on the other side of which is sort of everything else, is in a lot of ways a bad metaphor. A better metaphor for thinking about escalation is a ladder with many, many rungs. And And if you think of escalation not as a binary red line nuclear catastrophe and everything else, but as a ladder, both sides have been walking up that ladder gradually for years now. The level of violence and the level of mobilization on the two sides is substantially higher than it was when the war started. It's continuing to move upward. So I think the right way to think about escalation is what incentives are created by action acts, by giving the Ukrainians long-range weapons, by Russia mobilizing more forces, whatever, for the other side to walk up the next rung. And do you, how many rungs do you really want to walk up? And is this in your interest or not?
Well, that must have been part of the what's being described as a strategy discussion between Sir Keir Starmer and President Biden. They're being very coy. In fact, some people are saying that even if they have decided, they won't make it clear. Do you think Russian threats are playing on their mind, and how would they balance with what they would perceive as the need to give Kyiv the permission to use its long-range missiles into Russia?
Well, I think threats have to play on leaders' minds at some level. I mean, Joe Biden and the British government and the German government, the French government, all this are talking about small risks of potentially catastrophic things. I mean, if this thing eventually reaches a rung in the ladder that's as high as nuclear weapons. I mean, I think it's only responsible statesmanship to think about that. Now, you have to think about that in context of its likelihood, which is low. So I suspect a lot of the conversation with Biden and Starmer was about the kind of more immediate problem of, do we go up another rung or two on the ladder, and what does that do for war termination? Does that improve the odds that we get an end to this war on terms that the Ukrainians can live with or not, given that it's not likely to be the last step up the ladder, either by the West or by the Russians? I mean, the fundamental reality of this ladder is there's no way Ukraine is going to destroy Russia's ability to make war. I mean, they're not going to march on Moscow. They're not going to destroy Russia's mobilization base. If Russia retains the ability to make war, to end the war, Russia has got to decide that it would prefer to stop shooting than to continue shooting, and that means some sort of negotiated settlement. So I'm sure what Starmer and Biden were talking about is the prospect for a tolerable negotiated settlement, one the Ukrainians can live with and the West can live with, improved or not improved, by taking the next rung or two up the ladder.
Kyiv desperately wants to use these long-range missiles. How much of a game-changer would it be militarily?
It would certainly help them militarily. I mean, any kind of restriction always hurts you militarily, right? So in strictly military terms, of course it would be better for them if they didn't have the restriction. It would be better for them if they had a lot more of, you fill in the blank, artillery ammunition, long-range missiles, tanks, whatever. The question is how much. In exchange for whatever political consequence you think you encounter by walking up the ladder a little further, does this or does this not transform the military situation on the ground? It would help, but it's unlikely to be transformative.
Stephen Biddle, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for sharing some of your wisdom at this really quite tense time over the war in Ukraine. Stephen Biddle, Professor of International and Public Affairs from Columbia University. And coming up on NewsHour, the land in the southern Californian city of Rancho Palos Verdes is moving, and moving so fast, the authorities have cut off water and power supplies. Local officials tell us there are no easy solutions.
I would love to be able to say, we as a city screwed up this and we know exactly how to fix it because we messed. But honestly, we're still searching for engineering solutions. I mean, we think we know and understand things that we can do to mitigate it, but some of the ones we were about to expend $5 and $10 million on, we found they weren't going to work. And so we had to change course.
What to do about a sinking city? That's later. A reminder of our top story. Ukraine's president has again called for more long-range weapons after a meeting between the leaders of Britain and the United States ended without the announcement of a public change in policy on letting Kyiv hit targets deep inside Russia. You're listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. More men have now come forward accusing the former chief executive of the clothing company Abercrombie & Finch and his British partner of sexual exploitation. Mike Jeffries and Matthew Smith have been facing allegations that they exploited young men for sex at events they hosted around the world. The FBI has been investigating after the BBC revealed there was a sophisticated operation involving a middleman run for their benefit. That was the work of our investigations correspondent, Rhianna Croxford.
I didn't think it would ever come to light. I thought this was a very powerful individual who was basically untouchable.
This man, who I'm calling Luke, is one of 20 men I've now spoken with who attended or helped organise sex events hosted by Mike Jeffries and his British partner. These took place at their New York homes and hotels around the world from at least 2009 until 2015, while Mr. Jeffries was chief executive of the fashion brand.
This whole hotel room was completely converted to being a literal Abercrombie store. The photos and the tables, the plants, the cologne scents. It was like a movie set of an Abercrombie store. And I thought we were going to do a photo shoot.
In 2011, when he was 20, Luke says he received a message on a modelling website from a talent scout working for Mr. Jeffries. He says this man had offered him the chance of being in a company advert if he flew to Madrid. But on arrival, he said he was taken to a hotel room, which resembled a mock Abercrombie store. He says Mike Jeffries' assistants, young men in the brand's polos and flip-flops, were folding clothes, pretending to be shop workers.
And right away, it's like we go into character. The talent scout or house manager says, all right, guys, the first thing I want you to do is take off your shirts so you can, you know, you guys would be the guys at the Abercrombie store being the shirtless models. And he's like, all right, now I have two very important guests I'm going to bring into the store, and these are going to be the customers that you need to impress. And that's when Michael Jeffries and Mr. Smith came out of a corner of the room.
Luke says Mr. Jeffries and his partner Matthew Smith began touching him. He says the Abercrombie boss then performed oral sex on him and Mr. Smith tried to do the same.
Had he wanted any of that to happen?
No. I mean, definitely not. Absolutely not. I was trying to avoid the whole situation as much as I could, but Michael was very aggressive. I constantly was saying no and I wanted to go.
The FBI began investigating after the BBC revealed there was a sophisticated network involving a middleman tasked with scouting men for these events. Mike Jeffries and his partner also face a civil lawsuit accusing them of sex trafficking and rape.
I'm not scared of the FBI and I'm also not scared of a court.
This is Diego Gillen, a real estate broker who says he's been interviewed by the FBI. He says he would take the stand, if necessary, to defend Mike Jeffries.
Over the course of life, there's moments when people may have given you a hand for one thing or for another. And I am the type of person that believes that you should never forget that.
Back in 2011, Mr. Gillen says he was recruited while homeless and unemployed to attend several of these sex events. He says that everyone who attended the events he was present at
were under no obligation, under zero pressure, and they were treated excellently in every respect.
He told the BBC there was also a roster of attendees. Other sources have said this database could have as many as 60 different men on it, giving a snapshot of the scale of those recruited. But Mr. Gillen's view differs to the other men I've spoken with. Some have said they understood these events would be sexual, but not the specifics. Others, like Luke, have said they felt misled, exploited, and abused.
There's an immense amount of shame associated with, you know, or this image or idea that you're not a masculine man if you've been molested or taken advantage of by another man. I want to have the message that people can overcome things like this in their life and they can move forward.
Mr. Jeffries stepped down in 2014 after 2 decades in charge. He and Mr. Smith did not respond to requests for comment. However, their lawyers have previously said they deny allegations of wrongdoing. Abercrombie & Fitch said it does not comment on legal matters. With multiple investigations underway, it's now for the authorities and the justice system to decide what happens next.
And to hear more in this story, search for The Abercrombie Guys on BBC Sounds or wherever you find your podcasts. That's by Rhianna Croxford. Art, it can be a source of happiness for many of us. And around the world, Vincent van Gogh is certainly one of the most loved of all painters. He's often remembered for the mental health struggles which led him to take his own life. A new exhibition at the National Gallery in London wants to remind us his life contained happiness too. Vincent Dowd went to see the show.
No Van Gogh exhibition would seek to disguise his sad end, but Van Gogh Poets and Lovers focuses on the last 2 years of his life to show there were moments of joy as well, even in his time at the Saint-Rémy Asylum in Provence in the south of France, where he went seeking the mental balance he knew he lacked. Christopher Riopel is the co-curator.
The vast majority of Vincent's career is euphoric. With our tales of woebegone Vincent, we miss the fact this was a man in control of his own life. This image shows the hospital at Saint-Rémy, but look how he transforms the garden. We have photographs of it. Those trees aren't there. He is inventing this wonderful space where these trees take on, they're almost like giants dancing. Very colorful, particularly the range of greens and the way they play into the blues is really wonderful. But we notice in the lower left corner a woman with a beautiful parasol over her head, which is just a slash of bright red to animate the picture.
Chris, we've come into a different room where the big centerpiece is the two images of sunflowers, hugely famous in terms of Van Gogh. Why was Vincent obsessed with sunflowers?
There are a number of reasons. He saw a lot of symbolism in them, the sun, life blooming, etc.
They have so much sunlight, they kind of create a feeling of sunniness.
You're blasted by sunshine looking at them, but you're also, again, so drawn to the physicality of the way he paints those in big, thick strokes of color that stand proud on the canvas.
Here in the next room, three pictures clearly from Saint-Rémy. Did he change his colour palette in the relatively short time he was in Saint-Rémy?
The palette just gets brighter and brighter and purer. I mean, more and more you see just pure colours laid down on the canvas with incredible vivacity. He always realised he could do great things with yellow.
What do you suspect Vincent most liked painting?
He loved being confronted by people, and there is a certain joy in the portraits as well, but it's much more a sense of a face-to-face confrontation.
If we look at his take on human beings close up, they're wonderfully detailed, and there's often a sort of spark to them.
And that sense of a personal engagement is there. He loved people.
What are people going to learn from this exhibition, Chris, that they haven't learnt before?
Vincent was in control of his own career. He was plotting his own career, how he and his friends were going to make it as independent avant-garde artists in the world. And yes, he sold very few pictures during his lifetime. 25 years after his death, he was the most famous artist in the world. So he was doing something right.
And that was Vincent Dowd reporting for the Happy Pod podcast. To hear more of them, more happiness, search for BBC Happy Pod wherever you get your podcast. Stay with us here on NewsHour.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. The hit Netflix series Emily in Paris took a Roman holiday this week. Its full cast traveled to the Eternal City to launch part two of the show's fourth season. Now, you may or may not know, but the show follows a young American influencer finding her feet in Paris. Those seasons were criticized by Parisians who thought it romanticized their city and ignored the reality of rubbish, crime and tourists, etc. What about Rome? My colleague Paul Henley spoke to Italian BBC journalist David Giglioni in Rome.
I'm a fan. Yeah, I actually just watched it and it was quite funny. And to be fair, I was also smiling while I was listening to the short clips you played, because one of the lines from the Italian boyfriend, the new Italian boyfriend that Emily met, is, you know, do you prefer Paris or Roma? I think that every Roman sort of smiled when they heard that, because I do remember when the show came up a few years ago, and our colleagues in France, in Paris, our foreign correspondents were writing about it, describing how Parisians were outraged by the show and by how it didn't represent France. But I think that Romans have a bit of a different reaction to it. I think it's quite funny. And it's also something that's making Romans proud, because, you know, there's a bit of a rivalry between Paris and Rome about, you know, its beauty, food, fashion, people, architecture. And I think that Romans were like, oh, finally, she's traveling to Rome. Finally, she says buongiorno and not bonjour.
Do the Italians just embrace the cliches more, do you think?
Well, I think we do, certainly. I think we do see the problem of tourism. I think we do see the problem of, you know, especially Americans romanticizing the city a bit. But I think we're also very proud of it. And I don't want to say that Italians suffer from an inferiority complex when it comes to France and Paris. I'm Italian, so I do want to say that certainly we're a bit competitive when it comes to that.
Apparently, the love interest in the show picks up Emily on a Vespa, takes her to his friend's family-run pizza joint, and is nicknamed Limoncello. Come on. And then I read that you have a Vespa and a Fiat 500.
No, let me correct you. I have two Vespas. Oh. So one original from the 80s and one which I just bought a couple of weeks ago, which is exactly like the one in the show. So let me say, it's a bit of a cliche. I mean, I think they play with Italian cliches a bit, but there's a lot of it which is actually true. It doesn't necessarily represent everything. I mean, Rome, of course, has its problems. Pollution, rubbish, the outskirts. But I think it sort of captures the essence of at least central Rome. And I can tell you that if I have a date, I'll certainly use my Vespa and roam a lot.
Well, there you go. There's a of Emily fan, David Giglioni, a Roman. You're listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Today, the small Ugandan town of Buko is a place of mourning for their famous daughter, Olympic athlete Rebecca Cheptegei. The death of the 33-year-old marathon runner shocked the world. Rebecca was doused with petrol and set alight in her home in Kenya, where she had been training. Her former partner, blamed for her death, has since died of his injuries. Rebecca is receiving full military honours today because she was once a member of the Ugandan Armed Forces. Her body is also lying in state at a sports stadium, so the many people who want to pay their respects can do so. In a moment, we'll speak to our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, but first to Rebecca's coach, Njia Benjamin, who was at the funeral.
Of course, it is so saddening here and very unfortunate. Like, people are in a very sad mood, very sad. The whole government, the whole sub-region, the whole Ugandan athletic fraternity, and the whole entire world is really here to bid farewell to one of our greatest champions, the late Rebecca Cheptegei.
A lot of sadness. Is there also anger?
Yeah, a lot of sadness and anger, yeah, because this was a premature death. You see, the mood is really, people are very angry about this premature death. So it is really a very sad moment. And every speaker is really, really very sad.
Did she ever tell you that she felt threatened, that she felt her life was at risk? And from her former boyfriend specifically?
Yes, she told me about what was going on. And it was just like 2 days before her unfortunate loss of petrol that she came to capture her. She was narrating to me how the whole issue was going about. and I was advising her on what we could do next. But before that, previously, when we were in the national camp preparing for the Olympic Games, she told me about what she was going through, because there was one weekend when she escaped out of the camp. I asked her what is really the issue, because that time we really needed attention from all the athletes. Of course, unfortunately, she narrated to me the story, what she was going through and what was happening. Of course, she had told me the case was already in the CIDs, the detectives of the police from the Kenyan side. And she told me, she was briefing me that the case was going on successfully. So it was just very unfortunate that at the time that her case was going on to be a success in our side is when, of course, the malicious boyfriend did what he could on our side. I think it was out of that Rebecca was getting justice from her side, is when the boyfriend now thought differently.
So she was clear that he was threatening her life. He was very specific?
Yes, she was very specific. Even she had said this boyfriend threatens her on banning her. I think it kept on something until it matured in that lane.
The world has lost an impressive athlete, but you have also lost a friend. What will you miss about her?
I miss all the jokes, the laughs, and the determination, the courage in training. I really miss Rebecca, I'm telling you. She has been one of the most disciplined athletes, very determined, very committed in her career. Yeah, one of the role models of the youngest athletes in the camp. She used to talk to the young athletes, in a very proper way. Just that we have really lost one of those whom we thought she would mentor other young athletes. It's really very saddening.
Do you have other athletes who come to you with similar concerns? Do you worry about the future of others?
I come from also a security background. In fact, I take action. If it was in the Ugandan case, Rebecca's case could not have taken us very long. If it was in the Ugandan side, I would have intervened very fast. But we were trying to follow the protocols of government. So that that costed us to lose Rebecca. But if it was in the Ugandan side, we are very shift in action. So this should not happen again in our Ugandan side. And we request also in the other side of the Kenyan government that this should not happen to any other athlete.
A very sad day for so many. That was the coach, Shinjia Benjamin, of Rebecca Cheptegei. And we are going to join our correspondent, Senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy, in just a moment. But first, we're going to reflect back on what's happened in Gaza over the past week. It had some rare good news. Around 560,000 children under the age of 10 were successfully and safely vaccinated against polio during the first round of an emergency campaign. The head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, posted on X, formerly Twitter, that it had been a massive success against the tragedy of daily life for more than 2 million Gazans. But it was still a tough and dangerous week for aid workers. A UN convoy was blocked by Israeli forces. Another UN school serving as a shelter for displaced Gazans was attacked. Israel says Hamas fighters were using the school as a command and control center. 18 people were killed in that attack, including the shelter manager and 5 members of the biggest UN agency operating in Gaza, UNRWA. Israel says 9 of those kills belong to Hamas. Well, joining us here in our NewsHour studio is someone we often hear on the program, and she now is joining us here, the head of communications for UNRWA, Juliet Tuma. First of all, Julia, bring us up to date on what's with the school. It was condemned by the UN Secretary General as a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law. But Israel said it was yet again an example of Hamas using the school for military means. And it said some of your staff were members of Hamas. What is your information?
Liz, thanks for having me, and great to see you and everyone else. Sadly, what happened this week is commonplace. It is something that we're seeing reoccurring, and so are the statements from the Israeli authorities. Every time we have a school hit at UNRWA, we immediately see this statement. What really mattered to us this week is that we lost 6 of our colleagues who were managing that shelter. It's, it used to be a school that we turned shelter. There were thousands of people who were housed in that school, and six of our colleagues who were providing humanitarian assistance to people in that shelter were killed. It's the largest single attack, the largest loss in a single attack at UNRWA since the war began.
Have you been able to check whether any of your staff members had any affiliation to Hamas?
We did check that. We checked the names of the staff members who were killed against lists that the Israeli authorities have given us, Liz. And none of those killed in the incident earlier this week were on those lists.
This keeps happening, where Israel says its attacks because Hamas is embedding itself in civilian infrastructure, and UNRWA, which has lost, now you have lost more than 220 of your staff members. It continues to go up and up. Is there any way that this can be resolved?
Yes, through a ceasefire. And until then, parties to the conflict, including the Israeli army and the Israeli authorities, including Palestinian armed groups like Hamas, must respect United Nations buildings. They should never come under attack. They should never be used for military or fighting purposes.
There is what's called a deconfliction mechanism, which is supposed to keep aid workers, all of the aid agencies working in Gaza, safe. It's been set up. Has it ever worked?
So I think there are two different things. First of all, United Nations buildings must be protected at all times. And this is precisely why we share the coordinates of all our facilities or all our buildings, including the shelters, including the same school that was hit a few days ago. And why we do this, and we do this with the Israelis, but we also do it with the Palestinian armed groups, is because these buildings must be protected at all times. Now, there's also the deconfliction, which is when we do movements of personnel, when we do humanitarian convoys like the one that you referred to going up north, we work very, very closely with the Israeli authorities to seek an agreement and to move along the way. Now, quite so often, this deconfliction has not worked, including earlier this week.
Are you absolutely certain that Hamas is not using your buildings? They do need to find somewhere to hide, and we do know they do work and fire from civilian infrastructure.
There's absolutely no way for us at UNRWA to verify these claims. And this is precisely why the Commissioner General of the organization, Philippe Lazzarini, and many of us have called for an independent investigation to look into what we see as very, very serious claims, Liz.
Juliette Tuma, thank you very much for joining us in our studio. We're going to return now to our story about the funeral of Rebecca Cheptegei in Bukwo in Uganda. Our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy is there. Anne, we heard from the coach who's talked about the sadness and anger. Was there a big turnout for this morning?
It's been huge. In my estimation, probably thousands of people. They had dozens of tents set up, but all the seating space was taken up, and there were many, many more people who were standing. Obviously angered, but here to pay their last respects and their to show their love to somebody they describe as a humble member of the community who was much loved by many people here, somebody who inspired many children to take up athletics. It's a big blow for them. It's a big blow for the family. But they also hope that this is a turning point when it comes to domestic violence. Fellow athletes have come here today dressed in black T-shirts with a picture of Rebecca Cheptegei on the front and the inscription, "Say no to gender-based violence." So they are making their voices very clear about this issue. Where Rebecca Cheptegei lived in Kenya, she became the third elite athlete to be killed in just 3 years in the hands of people who were supposed to have loved them.
We heard from her coach, who was insistent that had this happened in Uganda, Uganda's rules would have kept her safe. Does he have a point?
Well, it's really hard to say. I have been speaking to legal experts in Kenya, campaigners against gender-based violence, and they say that the laws are there to protect potential victims of domestic violence. The challenge has been in the implementation, and the data they shared with us is that at least one in three women has faced some form of domestic violence in their lifetime. So it is, the statistics are very high. This is an endemic issue in the Kenyan society, and today they have been talking about that. The sports minister from Kenya, as well as his host from Uganda, have been here. The Kenyan minister said that they are working closely with the Ugandan counterparts to try and come up with solutions to end this violence.
And so I thank you for making time to speak with us from the funeral of the Ugandan Olympiad athlete, Rebecca Cheptegei. You're listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. The military leader of Myanmar has made a rare request. He's appealing for international aid to help deal with deadly flooding in large parts of his country. Min Aung Hlaing told officials to contact foreign governments for rescue and relief aid. In the past, the Myanmar military has blocked or frustrated humanitarian assistance coming from abroad. This new request underlines the gravity of this humanitarian crisis. There aren't many officially confirmed details, but initial reports suggest at least 160 people have died so far in recent days, most of them in the central and eastern parts of the country. I've been speaking to So Win Tan of the BBC's Burmese service, and I first asked him, how unusual is it for the military chief to make this kind of appeal?
It's quite unprecedented. The regime has this natural suspicion of international involvement in their own affairs. But the regime has always been blasted for refusing international offer of assistance, even when the country is going through some desperate moments. So this time, in a way that it shows their desperation. Also, the regime chief, junta chief, wanted to show that he is willing to work with the international community. But there is a caveat. They always insist that the international aid, even if it comes to Myanmar, then that should go through them. I mean, the aid could be delivered to them and they will do the distribution.
Is this in part because some of the worst affected areas are in rebel hands and the military would not want aid to go to them? Or are there other issues?
That's always the case. Like even in Rakhine State, or we had natural disasters in the past, and the regime was quite suspicious that when the international aid would be delivered, not through them, that would land in the hands of the opposition groups and troops. So they always insisted that they would manage by themselves. Currently, also the affected areas, many of those areas are in the hands of the rebel, but those suffer are the local people.
When they say they want foreign aid, do they prefer that it comes from a country with which they have close relations like China, or do they make it clear that Western aid would be acceptable this time?
They didn't make it clear. The junta chief just said that they would want international aid to give to the affected peoples. Usually what happens is that they are more comfortable with the countries in the region, ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which Myanmar is a part of. ASEAN already set up ASEAN Humanitarian Assistance Center, which already started to deliver aid, although it's in a very small scale, to the war-affected and internally displaced people. So, I mean, it's likely that they would go first to that ASEAN grouping and some individual countries. But still, it's likely that they would be very suspicious of Western involvement.
We've seen in disasters in other parts of the world, in conflict, that they out of the tragedy comes possible political openings. Is there any desire on the part of the military to end its isolation, to reach out to the West? And if so, would the West want to reciprocate?
Yeah, that is very difficult. With the history of the regimes, they have gone through so many kind of disasters and conflict, and they are still also very deep in this conflict, civil war. And they are also very suspicious of, especially the Western countries. They always said that the opposition groups receive assistance from the Western countries. So they would be quite reluctant. People are saying that we have seen in other like Aceh and other international conflicts, you know, that disasters helped open the dialogue process and reconciliation. But in Myanmar, it's quite unlikely. And also the opposition side, they both are quite dead set on crushing the other. So I don't see that this could be the very kind of big opening or opportunity for that kind of conflict resolution.
So Win Tan of the BBC Burmese service. And finally, the land is moving and sinking so fast in parts of the Southern California city of Rancho Palos Verdes that authorities have switched off gas and electricity indefinitely to hundreds of homes to avoid wildfires. It's left locals in a lurch. Many are refusing to evacuate. The BBC's Regan Morris sent us this report.
When you drive into Rancho Palos Verdes, the road goes up and down, and there are warning signs about constant land movement. Those warning signs come just after you pass one of the famous landmarks here, the Trump National Golf Course, where the former president held a press conference and addressed the people going through difficult times with so many landslides affecting their homes.
Before we begin, I want to express my support for all of the families affected by the landslides in Rancho Palos Verdes. The slides are something can be taken care of. This area is very solid. But you go down a couple of miles down, you'll see something that's pretty amazing. The mountain is moving and it can be stopped, but they need some help from the government.
I see the street. Look. This was flat. I bike rode here every day.
Jackie Gullison is one of the people who could use some help. Her house only has a few minor cracks, but like everyone else in her neighborhood, she's had her power and gas cut off, with utility companies saying the landslides are too much of a wildfire risk.
Big fissure. This is where everything's kind of gotten worse.
Oh, wow.
That's okay. What I want you to see. So turn right.
So that house is basically off its foundation?
I would say 10% are in this neighborhood. Look at that. You have to lift it so that the inside doesn't get destroyed.
That's how residents managed landslides for decades, lifting up their houses onto beams so they could move with the land. And that worked when landslides were moving things by about 30 centimeters per year.
So this is where the worst of it is.
But after 2 years of heavy rains, the land is now moving that much in some places every week.
People don't realize that not every house is split. People are like, oh, I heard... I'm like, no, we're still living in it. Why? I'm like, because we just built it and we put every dime we own into it.
City officials issued an evacuation warning after the first power shutoffs in early September because the sewer system was being shut down. But a group of residents rented generators to keep the sewage moving.
We got to get some more dry ice.
And many residents say they will never leave, vowing to move off of a grid they say has failed them. Climate change is partly to blame for the accelerating landslides, but residents also blame the city, saying they allowed overdevelopment and failed to line a canyon, which would have helped flush water to the ocean instead of causing chaos under their feet. Rancho Palos Verdes Mayor John Cruikshank met with Donald Trump and urged the former president to help get more state and federal aid to his city. The mayor is a civil engineer and says the neighborhoods most impacted by the landslides will likely need to move off-grid permanently.
I would love to be able to say, we as a city screwed up this and we know exactly how to fix it because we messed. But honestly, we're still searching for engineering solutions. I mean, we think we know and understand things that we can do to mitigate it. But some of the ones we were about to expend $5 and $10 million on, we found they weren't going to work.
And that was John Cruikshank ending that report by Regan Morris about a sinking city. That's all from NewsHour. Thanks for joining us.